All right, welcome in everyone to the deep dive. We're going to be unpacking a pretty interesting case today, one that you might not have heard of before.
Definitely an interesting one. Should be fun.
Yeah, we're diving into Colburn v. Armstrong. It went all the way up to the North Carolina Supreme Court back in 1956.
Wow, 1956, huh?
Yeah. And, at first glance, it might seem like just another property dispute, but there's a lot more to it than meets the eye.
Oh, absolutely. There's so many layers to this case. It's a fantastic example of how seemingly straightforward disputes can reveal some really crucial legal principles.
Exactly. And that's what we're here to explore today, like how juries are instructed, the rules that govern contracts, property ownership, all that good stuff. This case, it really highlights how important these concepts are and how, sometimes even small details can have a huge impact on the outcome of a case.
Right. And for all of you out there, whether you're in law school just starting out or you're already practicing, there are some big aha moments in Colburn v. Armstrong, stuff that will make you think, oh, okay, I get it now. Especially when it comes to how juries are guided and how contract disputes play out in court. It's a great case to learn from.
Absolutely. So for this deep dive, we're going to be looking at the court documents, of course. We'll be looking at how Colburn v. Armstrong has been analyzed over the years. We want to break down the facts, figure out what the core legal questions were, and see how the Supreme Court reached its decision, the whole nine yards.
Sounds good.
Okay, so let's start with the basics. What exactly was this dispute all about? Why did Colburn and Armstrong end up in court?
Okay, so at its heart, this was a classic property dispute. Colburn and Armstrong, they had this distributorship contract. It was partly written down and partly agreed to verbally.
Yeah.
Sometimes deals are made that way.
Yeah, happens all the time.
So Colburn, he was the plaintiff in this case. He claimed that Armstrong was hanging on to some inventory that actually belonged to him. According to Colburn, this was a breach of their contract, and it was costing him money.
So Colburn's saying, hey, that's my stuff, and you're not giving it back.
Yeah, pretty much. And of course, Armstrong had his own version of events. He claimed that the contract didn't require him to return the inventory at all. And he threw in another wrinkle, a bill of sale. He said Colburn had given him a bill of sale for at least some of the property, but then he claimed Colburn had destroyed it.
Oh, so he's basically saying, no, this property is actually mine. I have proof, but it's gone now.
Exactly. And that's where things start getting really complicated. It's a classic he said, she said situation.
Yeah, and to make matters even more complicated, there was another issue. Some of this property was actually owned jointly by both Colburn and Armstrong. So now we're talking about co-ownership.
Right. That's a crucial part of the case. And this is where things get really interesting from a legal perspective. Under North Carolina law, and this is generally true in most states, one joint owner, someone who co-owns property with someone else, they call them co-tenants, well, they usually can't just sue the other owner to get possession of the jointly owned property.
So it's not as simple as saying, hey, half of this is mine, give it to me.
Right. It's not that simple. Their rights to the property are generally considered equal. So the typical way to settle these kinds of disputes is through a special legal process called a partition proceeding.
Partition proceeding. Okay.
Basically, it's a legal action where the court can either divide the property physically or, which is more common, order it to be sold and then split the proceeds between the owners. That's the established way of dealing with co-ownership disagreements.
So you can't just bypass that process and go straight to suing for possession of the property.
Usually not, no. There are specific legal mechanisms in place for resolving co-ownership disputes, and for good reason. It ensures fairness and prevents one owner from taking advantage of the other.
Got it. Now, this case went all the way to the Supreme Court, and from what I understand, it wasn't just about the property itself. There was a big issue with how the jury was instructed right there.
You're absolutely right. That's actually the heart of what makes Colburn v. Armstrong so important, especially for those of us in the legal field. The North Carolina Supreme Court, they found a major problem with how the trial court instructed the jury. They said the instructions were inadequate.
Inadequate, meaning what exactly?
Well, basically, the Supreme Court found that the jury wasn't giving clear directions on some really fundamental aspects of the case. It's like giving someone a puzzle to solve, but not giving them all the pieces or telling them how the pieces fit together.
Okay. So they weren't told to ignore certain evidence or anything like that, but they weren't given the full picture. They didn't have all the tools they needed to reach a fair verdict.
Exactly. And that's a big deal. Remember, the jury's role is to decide the facts of the case. They have to figure out what really happened. But if they're not given clear guidance on what questions they need to answer, their decision can be flawed.
And what were some of the specific questions the jury wasn't asked to decide?
Well, for one, they weren't asked to determine if Armstrong was actually wrongfully possessing the disputed property. It's a pretty basic question, right? If Colburn's claiming that Armstrong was keeping his stuff illegally, the jury needs to figure out if that's actually true.
It seems obvious, but I guess sometimes the obvious things get overlooked.
And there were other key issues the instructions didn't address, like the parties had a separation agreement, and then they allegedly reconciled. The instructions didn't even mention how that might affect their property rights. And the bill of sale, the jury wasn't specifically asked to consider whether it was valid or what legal effect it might have.
Okay, so these weren't just minor details. These were pretty major points of contention in the case. And the jury wasn't even given the chance to weigh in on them.
Right. And the Supreme Court, they saw this as a huge problem. Because without clear factual findings on those issues, the trial court couldn't issue a proper judgment. It would be like building a house on a foundation of sand.
And the Supreme Court, they actually pointed out a specific problem with the verdict itself, right?
Yes, they did. The verdict the jury came up with, it was too vague. It wasn't specific enough to be legally enforceable. For instance, they awarded Colburn certain property, but didn't actually say what that property was.
Certain property? That's not very helpful, is it?
Not at all. Imagine trying to enforce that judgment. Okay, Mr. Armstrong, you need to return certain property to Mr. Colburn. Well, what property? Nobody knows.
It's like a riddle.
Right. And that highlights a fundamental legal principle. Verdict has to be clear, it has to be unambiguous, and it has to be specific enough that a judge can actually turn it into an order that can be enforced. This vagueness, it was a direct result of the inadequate jury instructions.
This case, it really shows how important it is to get those instructions right. It's like a roadmap for the jury.
Exactly. And that brings us to one of the key legal rules that Colburn v. Armstrong illustrates. Jury instructions have to address all the major issues raised by the parties in their pleadings, you know, the documents they file with the court outlining their claims and defenses. So remember that bill of sale Armstrong claimed Colburn destroyed?
Yeah.
Well, that was a disputed fact. It was a key part of the case. The instructions should have told the jury how to consider that evidence and how it might impact the question of who owned the property. They should have been given clear guidance on how to weigh that piece of the puzzle.
Makes sense. Now let's talk about Colburn's claim for breach of contract. What were the essential elements he had to prove to win that claim?
To prove breach of contract, Colburn had to convince the jury of two things. First, that Armstrong's actions actually violated the terms of their contract. And second, that he, Colburn, suffered financial losses because of that violation.
Yeah.
It's not enough to just say the contract was broken. You have to show that you were actually harmed by the breach.
And did the jury's findings address those elements?
Well, that's the problem. The Supreme Court found that the jury's findings didn't really address those key elements. It wasn't clear whether they'd actually found a violation of the contract or determined what damages Colburn had suffered.
And I imagine the continency rule we talked about earlier, that also played a role in the Supreme Court's decision.
Yes, it did. The Supreme Court emphasized that under North Carolina law, one co-owner generally can't just sue the other for possession of the property. They have to go through that partition process we talked about earlier. The Supreme Court was likely looking at whether Colburn's lawsuit was even the right legal approach, considering that some of the disputed property was jointly owned.
So let me make sure I'm following. The jury instructions were flawed, the verdict was too vague, and there were questions about whether Colburn's lawsuit was even the proper way to handle the co-owned property. What did the North Carolina Supreme Court ultimately decide to do?
Well, considering all those issues, the Supreme Court decided to vacate the original judgment and order a brand new trial.
Wow, a whole new trial. That's a pretty big deal.
It is. Basically, the Supreme Court said the first trial was a do-over. The flawed jury instructions meant that the fundamental factual disputes hadn't been resolved properly. So, to ensure fairness, they sent the case back to the trial court to be tried again, this time with the jury properly instructed on all the crucial issues.
And what's the biggest takeaway here for our listeners, especially those who are in law school or just starting out in their legal careers?
I think the biggest lesson here is the crucial importance of crafting jury instructions carefully. They need to be clear, comprehensive, and they need to address all the key issues in the case. If even one essential element is missing, it can undermine the entire trial. Colburn v. Armstrong is a perfect example of how overlooking seemingly small details can lead to huge consequences.
It's a good reminder that procedure matters. It's not just about knowing the law. It's about applying it correctly.
Absolutely. This case shows how important it is for legal professionals to get those procedural steps right, to ensure that juries have all the information they need to reach fair and just verdicts.
So to recap our key takeaways from Colburn v. Armstrong, jury instructions need to be crystal clear and cover all the bases. Verdicts have to be specific and enforceable. When it comes to breach of contract, you have to prove both a violation of the agreement and actual damages. And when dealing with co-owned property, there are specific legal rules that must be followed. This case really highlights how these principles work in the real world.
And more broadly, this case shows how vital the jury's role is in our legal system. They're the ones who decide what really happened. And to do their job effectively, they need clear, comprehensive instructions.
So for those of you listening, think about this. In our legal system, cases can be incredibly complex. There are often so many moving parts, so many details to consider. How can we, as legal professionals, make sure that jury instructions are not only accurate and complete, but also easy for jurors to understand? How can we make sure they have all the tools they need to reach a just verdict? It's a balancing act. We need legal precision, but we also need clarity for the jury, something to think about.
It definitely is. It's a challenge, but it's one we have to meet to ensure that our justice system works fairly and effectively.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Well, thanks for joining us for this deep dive into Colburn v. Armstrong. It's a case that, despite its age, still has a lot to teach us about the law and how it works.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
And to everyone listening, we'll see you next time on The Deep Dive.